so as they wouldn't catch the fever. The death cart will get him soon for burying.
I couldn't help but stare as the wagon rolled by the stoop. He looked about 17 and wore well-tailored clothes, stained with the effects of the fever. Only his polished boots remained clean. His yellow eyes stared lifelessly at the clouds, and flies collected on his open mouth. "Won't there be a burial? A church service?" I asked as the driver turned east onto Walnut Street.
"Most preachers are sick or too exhausted to rise from their beds. A few stay in the square during the day. That takes care of the praying."
How could the city have changed so much? Yellow fever was wrestling the life out of Philadelphia, infecting the cobblestones, the trees, the nature of the people. Was I living through another nightmare? "What date is this?" I asked Mrs. Bowles.
"Today is September the 24th, she answered.
"The 24th? That's not possible. I counted on my fingers. We fled on the 8th. When we left, there were reports of 1,000 dead. Do you know what the total is now?"
"It's double that, at least," she said. "It slowed down those few cool days, but as soon as the temperature rose again, so did the number of corpses."
The driver pulled on his reins to stop the horses. The road was blocked by a line of slow-moving carts, each pushed by a man with a rag tied over his face. Each holding a corpse.
"The Potter's Field is ahead,"
Mrs. Bowles said as she pointed to the front of the line.
"That's where they're burying most of the dead. The preachers say a prayer and someone throws a layer of dirt on top."
Along one side of the square stretched a long row of mounded earth. The grave diggers had dug trenches as deeply as they could, then planted layer after layer of fever victims. Some of the dead were decently sewn into their winding sheets, but most were buried in the clothes they died in. "A field plowed by the devil," I murmured. "They're not even using coffins."
"I haven't seen a coffin for 4-5 days now," the driver answered.
He flicked the reins and urged the horses on. At 5th Street, the wagon stopped.
"Here's the orphan house," said Mrs. Bowles. "We've taken over the home of William Ralston, though we'll soon need more room."
It was an ordinary-looking house, more expensive than some, but typical of Philadelphia. Brick front, windows trimmed in white paint, metal railings, and a thick oaken door. The driver helped down Mrs. Bowles and Susanna, then each of the children. Mrs. Bowles put Susanna in charge of shepherding 3 of the children inside and stayed to wave goodbye. The driver climbed back into his seat, then flicked the reins on the horses' backs.
"Remember what I said, Matilda," she called. "Take care. Whatever you do, take care."
Chapter 17. September 24th, 1793. I cannot anticipate nor limit the period when the devastation and horror too long experienced in this miserable place will have an end. Letter of John Walsh, Clerk, Philadelphia, 1793. By the time we reached the coffee house, it was midday. An ugly yellow scrap from a ripped bodice was still tied to the handle of the front door, which was open. I jumped out of the wagon before it had stopped moving. I leapt up the steps and burst through the doorway. "Grandfather, hurry!" The front room was a jumble. Tables and chairs lay helter-skelter. The clock was missing from the mantel. The pewter candle holders were nowhere to be found. King George's birdcage lay on the floor in pieces, as if smashed by a heavy boot. Grandfather hadn't seen the foul-mouthed parrot in days. Had he come home and flown off again? The destruction in the kitchen was greater. Broken pottery covered the floor.
The doors to the pantry stood open, and Eliza's crocks of preserves, the sugar cone, and her spice cabinet were missing. The coffee and tea canisters lay on their sides, empty. The dried meat, beans, and onions that usually hung from the ceiling had vanished. Even the kitchen table was overturned. Something crunched behind me. I whirled around, but it was only Grandfather picking his way across the broken plates.
"What happened here?"
he asked quietly. His eyes moved over the mess, but it did not look like he could make sense of it.
"I was just here a few days ago. I locked the door, Maddie. I'm sure."
His voice was on the edge of trembling. I picked up pieces of broken glass. "Don't fret," I said. "Someone broke in the window. You locked the door, Grandfather. It's not your fault."
"Did they take anything from upstairs?"
My heart thudded against my stays. Before Grandfather could say another word, I had lifted my skirts and raced up the staircase. The second floor looked as I had left it, except that Mother was missing. The powerful stench of sickness lingered. I opened the windows and shutters to bring in fresh air, then crossed the hall. My bed was still in Grandfather's chamber. I glanced in to make sure everything was in its place. The room still held his presence, his books on the nightstand with an old pipe. A painting of Grandmother hung over his bed, with a picture of the farm where he grew up beside it. Whoever destroyed the first floor hadn't bothered coming up here. I went downstairs to rejoin Grandfather. The clothes press at the bottom of the stairs was untouched, the bed linens and tablecloths stacked in it as neatly as if Mother had set them there a moment ago. I lingered in front of it. It was almost possible to forget everything if I just focused on the scent of lavender and clean cotton and the beeswax that made the wood glow. Grandfather was picking through the broken chairs in the front room, trying to salvage something to sit on. I opened all the windows and propped open the doors. There wasn't a breath of air to be had. The room still held the faint smell of coffee and tobacco smoke, but dust coated the furniture and the floor. Spider webs hung in the corners of the room. It felt like I had been gone a lifetime.
"Have a seat, girl,"
Grandfather instructed.
"You're still weak."
"Only if you sit as well," I said. "Your face is as red as an overripe cherry." I did not mention how hard he was breathing. We moved two chairs to the door, where the air was a mite cooler. He massaged his left arm.
"Old battle wound,"
he said when he noticed my concern.
"This arm goes pins and needles from time to time. The heat doesn't help any, nor this commotion."
He was still breathing hard, but his eyes had lost that glazed look they'd had in the kitchen. He needed a good night's sleep in his own bed, I decided. "Right. When you were here a few days ago, everything was in order and locked up tight. You thought that Mother had gone to the Luddington's farm."
"And Eliza,"
he said.
"She would have asked Eliza to join her."
"Eliza wouldn't go. She has family here and would have wanted to help. You know Eliza would never run from trouble." He nodded his head. "Whoever came here didn't go above stairs," I continued. "Maybe they saw the fever rag and thought there was still an invalid in the house."
"It didn't stop them from destroying everything they touched," he said. "Was anything else stolen?"
"Food. They took every scrap of food in the kitchen, even the..." I froze. "The strong box!" I fumbled with the tread of the hollow stair, then threw it to the side and lifted out the metal box. I opened the lid. It was still there, pence and shillings. Thank heaven for that. I returned the box to its hiding place. It could be worse, I thought. The house is still standing. We're alive. Mother and Eliza must be somewhere safe. I had to believe that. The fever would soon be over, and our lives would return to normal. I just had to stay clever and strong and find something to eat. A tear surprised me by rolling down my cheek. None of that, Maddie girl, I whispered to myself as I scrubbed the tear away. This is not the time to be childish. A familiar yowl came from the back door. Silas waited at the threshold, unwilling to risk his paws on the messy floor. I carried him into Grandfather. "Here's a friendly face," I said as I held the cat close. "He seems healthy enough." I scratched between his ears. Silas rubbed his face in my hair. "Why didn't you scare those intruders away?"
"They probably fed the beast a bite of ham, and he showed them the way to Eliza's goodies," said Grandfather.
He tried to lift his sword and scabbard to its place over the mantel, but his arms shook too badly. I set Silas down and took the sword from him. "Let me help you," I said. I raised the sword to its resting place.
"Thank you, my sweet,"
Grandfather said.
"Don't know what's come over me."
"I know," I said firmly. "We've just come through a battle, and you need time to recuperate." I wagged my finger at him like a commanding officer. "Captain Cook, you must report to your bedroll immediately for an extended leave, sir. Fresh water will be fetched for you." He saluted me.
"Yes, ma'am, General Maddie."
I listened with envy as his boots shuffled up the stairs and clumped into his chamber. I wanted to take a nap. Why couldn't someone else come to clean up the mess and fetch the water? Silas looked at me skeptically. "You're right," I sighed. "If I don't do it, no one will. But first, I need something to eat. Even Mother believed in a good meal before chores. Let's get Grandfather's water and see what we can salvage for supper." Silas followed me outside. Oh, my gracious! The garden looked dead. Insects had devoured most of the leaves and vegetables, leaving behind skeletons of stems and branches. Weeds had exploded between the neat rows. All those weeks of back-breaking work had been for nothing. Hot tears threatened, but my grumbling stomach was more painful. I drew a bucket of water from the well and used the dipper to drink as much as I could hold. I spilled the dipper over the top of my head, shivering as the cold water trickled down my back. I carried the bucket inside and poured a mug for Grandfather. He was already asleep by the time I entered his room. His color was better, and he was snoring like a barn full of plow horses. I set the mug on the floor and tiptoed back downstairs. The ground was baked too hard to use the hoe. I decided to pull up what I could and hope to find something edible overlooked by varmints. A cloud of bugs swarmed around my face every time I touched a withered plant. I weeded the bean patch and found a few hidden string beans for my efforts. The cabbage plants were so infested with worms I couldn't bring myself to look at them. Every few minutes I crawled under the cherry tree for shade and another cool drink of water. Ants covered the cherries that lay on the ground, but I found enough on the tree to settle my stomach. Silas climbed up to a cozy nook between two branches and went to sleep. "I'll not forget all your help, wretched cat," I muttered as I knelt in the squash patch. An hour later, I examined my treasure on the kitchen table. 2 handfuls of green beans, 4 stunted crookneck squash that had been nibbled by mice, and a few sour cherries. I divided the meal into 2 piles, one for me and one for Grandfather. "Not exactly a banquet, is it?" I asked Silas. Silas jumped on the table and lapped the water in my mug.
"Oh, no, you don't," I said as I lifted Silas off the table. "We still have rules, even if Mother isn't here to enforce them. Cats eat on the floor." I poured a bit of water into what was left of a bowl for him. I tasted a green bean.
tough as leather, but not as tasty.
I suddenly remembered what was missing. I pushed the bean to the side of my mouth and bowed my head.
Thank you, Father, for keeping me alive. Please punish the terrible people who wrecked our home and stole our food. No, that's not right. They were probably hungry. Punish them a little bit for taking so much. They should have left something behind, and they had no reason to break things. Deal with them as you see fit. Please take care of Mother and Eliza and Grandfather. I sat in silence for a moment. And Nathaniel. Chapter 18. September 25th, 1793.
I think the malady is becoming more alarming. More than one half of Philadelphia has emigrated.
Letter of John Walsh, Clerk, Philadelphia, 1793.
Silas woke me the next day by purring next to my head.
I rose and stretched, enjoying the coolness brought by the night.
Grandfather snored across the room.
We had survived one day and one night.
I crept downstairs. I wanted Grandfather to get as much rest as he could.
My skin was crusty with filth, and I itched. No doubt I looked a fright and smelled worse. I made my first decision of the day. I needed a bath.
Much as I hate to start a fire on a day like this, we have to boil water, I told Silas.
I fumbled with the flint and tinder until a spark jumped, and I built a respectable blaze. It was a shame there was no one to boast to but Silas. I didn't bother putting a skirt or bodice over my shift to haul water from the well. It felt too good to walk across the garden unburdened by heavy skirts.
Nobody can see me, I told Silas, who watched with disapproval. There isn't another soul for blocks.
I dumped bucket after bucket of water into Eliza's biggest pots and swung them over the fire. As the water heated, I scavenged in the garden again. Gardening at dawn, in a thin shift and with loose hair, was nearly fun. I felt like a sprite or a hungry leprechaun, turning over leaves in search of a treat, looking under weeds for a pot of gold or perhaps a turnip.
Gardening in nightclothes could become a new fashion, I thought.
Imagine plump Mrs. Ogilvy planting radishes in a red-striped nightcap. That would be a sight to turn Philadelphia on its ear. The bubbling pots of water made the air in the kitchen thick and hard to breathe. I dragged the bathing tub into the front room and filled it with boiling water. When the tub was half full, I added cold water straight from the well until the temperature was comfortable. I closed the shutters, bolted the front door, and closed the door to the kitchen. Assured of privacy, I removed my shift and settled into the warm water. It felt strange to take a bath like this, the house so quiet, no sound from the street, alone except for a nosy orange cat. I usually bathed once a month, or for special occasions. I stuck my leg up in the air and rubbed it with soap. This felt like a special occasion. The water soon turned brown with weeks of dirt and sweat. I held my breath and dunked my head under the water. I scrubbed my hair with soap and dunked again, over and over, until my hair was free of blood and filth. I rubbed the soap on a rag and scrubbed my skin until it burned. When even the soles of my feet were clean, I dried myself by the kitchen fire. My skin crawled at the thought of putting on my dirty clothes again. The only other clothes that fit me were someplace in the Pennsylvania countryside with the farmer who had abandoned us. I slipped on my shift and went up to my bedchamber. I eyed Mother's trunk. I was nearly as tall as she, even if I didn't fill out a bodice the way a grown woman did. I swallowed. I promise I won't wear any of your clothes to go fishing or climb trees, I said aloud as I opened the latch. Mother's shift and blue and white striped overskirt fit better than I had imagined. They were made of cotton, spun fine and tightly woven, and felt as light as silk after wearing my dirt-encrusted homespun for so long. I twirled around the room, ready for a ball, curtsying to the east corner and then the west. This would suit me fine. It was time to wake Grandfather. Too much sleep could be as bad as not enough, and I needed his help in the garden. He was sleeping on his back, his arms thrown to either side. His chest rattled with every breath, and his face was the color of spoiled cream. Perhaps we should have found a way to stay at Bush Hill. He still wasn't over his cough. Mrs. Flagg would have welcomed the chance to dote on him for a few days. But she had other responsibilities. I could take care of Grandfather. I shook his shoulder gently. Grandfather, time to wake. I found a few things to eat, and we have much to do today. He opened one eye.
I'll have a dozen eggs, a loaf of bread, and basket of plums, please.
He mumbled. Your stomach will feel better if you don't talk about food, I replied. But we'll find something today. I floated down the stairs, clean, fresh, and hungry. Silas trailed behind me, swatting at the edge of my skirt. I don't suppose you could be useful and catch me a bite to eat, I said. No mice, mind you. A fat chicken would be lovely, or a length of sausage, or beef stew. Listen to me, I'm as bad as Grandfather. I set a small pot of water to boil and added the beans and turnip. The thieves hadn't bothered to take any of the herbs drying overhead. I sprinkled parsley and sweet thyme into the water. While the soup cooked, I swept the kitchen floor clean of the broken crockery. It made so much noise I did not hear Grandfather enter the room.
It sounds like you're tearing the house apart, board by board, he said.
He squinted.
Excuse me, miss. Have you seen my granddaughter, Maddie? She must be around here somewhere. Filthy little urchin she is, wearing a grimy dress and a ragged cap.
Get on with you, I said. There's no call to be rude, and the bathwater is still warm, if you don't mind it gritty.
I'm a soldier, girl. I've bathed in icy streams,
I interrupted. Frozen lakes and rushing rivers. I know, a real soldier doesn't need hot water. But I don't want you smelling like a real soldier, thank you very much, especially in this heat. Once you've finished bathing, put your dirty clothes in the water. I'll wash them later. Grandfather bathed quickly and was polite about his breakfast soup. It was slightly better than warm water with weeds in it, but not by much.
Don't suppose there's any way we could convince Eliza to come back right away, is there?
Grandfather asked as he forced himself to swallow another spoonful. That wouldn't be right, I said. I'm sure she's helping the people who are truly needy, folks sick with fever, who can't care for themselves. We shouldn't be greedy.
Is there much food in the garden?
He asked. A little, I answered. We need to find someone who will sell us some bread and meat. He shook his head slowly.
I don't like the idea of leaving the house,
he said.
The world out there has turned upside down.
He unbuttoned his top button and coughed.
What if we were gone, and Lucille came by with a wagon searching for us? No, we're safe here, and I don't want to hear any more talk of venturing outside, unless it's to the garden. We'll stick to home, until we don't have a choice.
I spent the afternoon watering and watering and watering. Grandfather tried to help, but his left arm wouldn't listen to him.
As soon as he stepped into the sunshine, his face turned that terrible shade of red again, and he could barely breathe. I begged him to stay on the porch. He blustered and complained at first, but decided it was high time he cleaned and oiled his old rifle. Maybe he could hunt squirrel when the weather cooled. The pole beans looked better, and the squash leaves spread like wide green hands shortly after I watered them. I had never thought a person could be proud of a squash plant, but I was ready to hug all of mine. I hauled buckets of water to the potato patch, drenching the plants which looked healthiest. When the plot was water-soaked, I gently poked the mud with my fingers until I found 6 fist-sized potatoes. I danced a few steps as I carried my prizes up to the back porch where Grandfather sat in the shade. "Potatoes!" I cried. "Potatoes, potatoes, potatoes!"
"What on earth has gotten into you, girl?"
he asked. I spun around his chair. "This is my potato dance, Grandfather. Look what I found. We'll have a real supper tonight. Have you ever seen anything as beautiful as a potato?" Supper was a royal feast of boiled potatoes, seasoned with a scrawny turnip and a few beans. But there was enough to ease the ache in our stomachs. Grandfather found a small bag of roasted coffee beans the thieves had overlooked, and he cooked a pot for us, army style. Hot mud would have tasted better, but he was so pleased with himself I forced myself to drink it. Oh, for some sugar and cream. I was ready to fall asleep before the sun set. I carefully pushed the coals to the back of the fireplace and covered them with ashes. I drew a final bucket of water, washed the dishes, and set them on the table. I never did understand why Mother made me dry the dishes. I left them on the table. They would be dry by morning. After I dumped the wash water at the base of the cherry tree, I dragged up the stairs, ready to fall into bed. Grandfather had already collapsed on his covers, snoring loud enough to shake the stars from the sky. The noise was unbearable. If I stayed, I'd get no sleep at all. I carried my blankets downstairs to the front room and made a soft pallet on the floor. "If I leave the shutters open, do you promise you won't run off in the night?" I asked Silas. The cat turned in a circle on the blanket and closed his eyes. "Very well, then. The shutters stay open. We'll both sleep better for it." I sat next to Silas. It had been a good day, all things considered. I had managed rather well on my own. I opened Grandfather's Bible. This is what it would be like when I had my own shop or when I traveled abroad. I would always read before sleeping. One day, I'd be so rich I would have a library full of novels to choose from. But I would always end the evening with a Bible passage. I turned to Psalm 4, verse 8. "I will both lay me down in peace and sleep, for Thou, Lord, only makest me dwell in safety." My eyes drooped. Enough for one night. I blew out the candle and snuggled on my pillow, asleep before the wick had cooled. Chapter 19. September 26th, 1793. Shafts of death fly closer and closer to us every day. Dr. Benjamin Rush, Letter, 1793. I dreamt of roast beef sliced pink and dripping with juice. A roast beef bigger than a horse set on a giant platter that took up the entire front room, surrounded by steaming potatoes and parsnips and loaves of fresh bread. I had a bowl of butter all to myself and my very own pitcher of cold apple cider. The smell of mincemeat pie floated in from the kitchen. I lifted the first bite to my mouth when a noise snapped me awake. A footstep,
A heavy footstep by the window.
Silas scrambled off the blanket and ran across the floor.
What was that?
A strange voice asked. The room was silent. I held my breath.
Probably a rat,
a second voice answered.
Hurry up! Get in there!
Another footstep landed by the window. I turned toward the noise and saw a thin man in the moonlight. He was nearly as tall as the door, but I couldn't see his face. He glanced around the room. His eye did not catch me in the shadows. A second man entered through the window, shorter than the first.
There's no one here,
the tall one said with more confidence in his voice.
You worry too much.
I closed my eyes. I am still dreaming, I thought. These men are not here. I opened my eyes again. The tall one opened one of the cupboards built into the wall by the hearth. The short one peered outside.
I saw what I saw, and I saw smoke coming out of the chimney today,
the short one said.
I don't know why I follow you. We should have gone to 4th Street. Nobody down there.
He tapped the back of a chair nervously.
You worry too much. Look at this fireplace. There's been no light here for weeks. Come away from that window and help me. They don't serve whiskey here, but they have plenty of pewter and silver hidden somewhere, no doubt. Check the drawers over there, he said as he pointed to the chest behind me.
My stomach flipped. What should I do? If I screamed, Grandfather might wake, and they could attack us both. The front door was locked, and I didn't have the key. I could try to slip out the window and run for help. But who could I run to? Would anyone bother with a trifling robbery when there was death at every door? The short man took a few steps in my direction, then stopped. He turned his back to me.
It's too dark over here. I need a candle.
I slipped out of the blankets and into the corner. I needed to get them out of the house. If I could sneak out the window, I might try to scare them off.
The tall one swore. You don't need a candle. Shut up and do what you're told.
I froze against the wall as the short one approached, grumbling under his breath. The window was just beyond my left hand, and the chest of drawers was on the other side of the window. The short one stood 3 feet away. I tried not to breathe.
Look at this,
the short one said as he held up a chess figurine. Grandfather had won that chess set in a card game with a ship's captain from Siam. He taught me to play chess before I learned how to read. I simmered as the thief rubbed the queen with his dirty fingers.
It's not worth nothing hereabouts, he said. But I bet it would fetch a handsome sum in New York.
He opened a sack tied to his belt and put the chess piece in.
My hands balled into fists as he collected the rest of the chess pieces. King, bishop, knight, pawn, all smudged with his fingers, polluted by his breath. How dare he? My jaw tightened. Why were they here, standing in my front room, stealing the hard work of my family? I wanted to drop him into a sack and boot it out the door.
The tall thief lifted Grandfather's sword from the mantel.
Go to New York if you wish, but I know a gentleman in Wilmington who will pay a pretty price for this. That's not worth a continental,
the short one laughed.
I could get a better price for my old stockings. Every old man in America drags his rusty sword around and claims he ran it through 100 British. It's a piece of junk.
I glared at him from my hiding place. Grandfather did kill British soldiers with that sword. He told me so himself. Steady on, Maddie. Crawl out the window as soon as he looks away. The tall one pulled the sword from the scabbard and slashed it through the air.
Maybe I won't sell it, then. It could be a handy weapon.
He tested the blade with his thumb.
Still sharp, and I don't see a bit of rust. I could become a highwayman.
He advanced across the floor toward his partner, waving the sword.
What ho there, my good man! I have come to relieve you of your purse.
Give over. Let's fill our bags and leave. You can play at the tavern.
The tall one would not relent. He pressed ahead, continuing to brandish the sword back and forth wildly. The tip of the blade swept by my face. He shuffled forward another foot and waved his arm again, the sword level with my neck.
No! I screamed as I ducked. As soon as the sword passed over me, I ran for the kitchen, colliding with the tall man and knocking him down.
It's a ghost!
The short man cried.
It's a girl, you fool! The tall one growled as he jumped to his feet. Get her!
I ran through the kitchen to the back door and fumbled with the bolt. The thieves' footsteps thudded on the oak floor. Open, open, open! The bolt slid back. I pushed down the latch and opened the door. I crossed the porch in two steps and ran across the warm earth toward the gate. My foot came down hard on a sharp rock. I cried out, but kept running. The gate was only a few more steps. Faster, faster. Two bony hands curled around my shoulders like the claws of a panther and yanked me backward. I hit the ground so hard it knocked the breath out of me. The tall man picked me up and carried me back into the house, where the short man was finishing his search through the chest of drawers.
You should have let her go, the short one said. What good is she to us? This haint here will tell us where they've hidden all their silver. I'm sure they have a strong box as well,
the tall man said as he tied my wrists together in front of me.
I spat at him.
Smack! The tall man slapped me across the face, jerking my head backward.
Don't hit her,
the short man protested.
I'll do what I please,
the tall man said as he wiped his face on his sleeve.
Now, Missy, the silver and the strong box, where are they?
We've already been robbed. They took everything. You're too late, I said.
See, we're too late. Let's go.
The short man pulled on his partner's sleeve.
Shove off, the tall man shouted. What if she's lying? You think she's going to hand over all her money because we ask her nicely? She needs to be convinced.
He drew back his arm to hit me again. Thump.
What was that noise?
The tall man demanded.
What noise?
Asked the short man.
I just heard a noise. Upstairs.
He looked at the ceiling. I shouldn't have screamed. Grandfather must have heard me and gotten out of bed. I needed to get these men out of the house.
Who's up there? I thought you were alone,
said the tall man.
It's just my cat.
I tried to keep the fear from my voice.
Everyone else has died of yellow fever.
I lied. Saints preserve us, more fever victims, groaned the short man. Let's go now. This wench is probably fever-poisoned, too. She don't look too good.
The tall man hesitated.
She's hiding something,
he said. He drew back suddenly and hit me in the face again. My head rang and lights danced before my eyes.
Where's the money?
The man demanded.
Tell me where the money is. Get away from my granddaughter!
Grandfather stood in the doorway in his nightshirt, his rifle aimed at the heart of the man who had hit me.
Oh, Lord,
said the short man. He put one leg out the window.
I'm going to 4th Street. The houses are empty and the cupboards are full. He's not going to shoot,
said my attacker.
Look at him. He can barely stand. His knees are knocking together. One puff and he'll blow over. Isn't that right, old man? Now tell me where you've hidden the money, or I'll have to hurt this little girl here. I'll count to three,
said Grandfather. He wasn't fooling around. Grandfather never fooled around when he counted to three. The few times he had whipped me had been when he counted to three, and I didn't listen.
One.
The short robber scrambled out the window without another word.
Two.
Grandfather swayed to one side. He was breathing heavily. Too heavily.
No, Grandfather,
I pleaded.
Put the gun down.
He licked his lips and stared down the barrel.
Three.
Everything happened at once. The gun fired just as the tall man leapt to the side. The blast knocked Grandfather against the doorframe. The tall man jumped on Grandfather and punched him in the face. I kicked at the tall man until he hit me with the back of his hand and sent me sprawling. I struggled to my feet. Grandfather's sword still lay on the floor where the robber had dropped it. I picked up the sword, holding it with two hands. Grandfather had taught me a bit about sword play, along with his other army lessons. Let go of him! I shouted. The man ignored me. His hands were around Grandfather's throat. Grandfather weakly hit back at the man, but it had no effect. The man struck Grandfather's head against the floor. Grandfather's eyelids fluttered, then closed. No! I screamed. I swung the sword and gashed the thief's shoulder. He howled and rolled to the side, grasping at the bloody wound. You cut me, he said in disbelief. The wench cut me with the sword. Get out of my house before I cut out your heart! I raised the sword and ran at him. He lurched to the window and crawled through it. I followed, screaming the kinds of words that would have raised every hair on my mother's head. I chased the man for a block before I realized that Grandfather was out of danger. But he needed me back home, not standing in the street in the dead of night brandishing a bloody sword like a pirate. He was sitting up when I returned. Don't move. I'll help you. I dropped the sword to the floor and struggled free of the bonds that held my hands together. He looked at me with a slow smile.
Always knew you had it in you,
he said hoarsely.
You're a fighter. No doubt about that.
Hush, don't say a word, I cautioned. I grabbed my bedding and made a pillow for his head. I'll get you some water.
No,
he insisted. He grabbed my shift.
Stay.
The moonlight quivered as thin clouds scuttled across the sky. I could smell the stench of the intruders and the soap Grandfather had used to wash his face before he went to sleep. His eyes started to close, but he forced them open. He fumbled for my hand.
I'm sorry, Maddie,
he panted.
I'm leaving you alone.
I shook my head mutely. No, no, this would not happen. No, please, God, anything but this. He nodded once.
My time. Too early. So sorry.
I covered my mouth to hold in the scream and rocked back and forth. After all he had been through, to die like this. Don't die. I couldn't hold the words back. Don't die, Grandfather. Please, don't die. I love you. Please, please. Oh, dear God, please don't die. My face was wet, my tears splashing onto his cheeks.
Strong,
he whispered.
Beautiful. Clever. My sweet Maddie.
His eyes closed. I bent down to kiss his forehead. I thought I heard his last words.
Love you.
Dead? Grandfather couldn't be dead. My grandfather, candy-giving, wood-chopping, tobacco-smelling grandfather, who carried me through Philadelphia like a princess, who knew every politician, printer, carpenter, and captain, who fed stray dogs, who curbed mother's tongue, who carved me a doll's cradle, who dried my tears. Dead. I held my breath and waited for the earth to stop spinning. The sun need not rise again. There was no reason for the rivers to flow. Birds would never sing. The sound came straight from my heart, as sharp as the point of a sword. I shrieked to the heavens and pounded the floor with rage. No, no, no! Don't take him! No, no, no! I picked up the sword and attacked a chair as if it were death itself. When the chair was a pile of firewood and the sword dull, I fell to my knees by the side of my grandfather's body. Dead.
growing cold. I straightened his arms and legs so he might lay with dignity. What should I do next? There was no one to ask. I felt like a baby girl just learning to walk. Only the ground under my feet was shaking, and I had no one to hold on to. Silas padded in and rubbed himself along Grandfather's hand. He lay down beside me. I took a shaky breath and looked at the face that had loved me so much. The light was gone from his eyes, blown out. I gently closed his eyes with my fingertips. I was not afraid to touch him. There were other things to do. Think now. I tried to remember the funerals I'd seen. I dimly remembered seeing an elderly woman's body during a wake when I was younger. There was a bandage round her jaw to keep her mouth closed. I pulled myself from the floor and marched to the clothes press. I took out a few of our finest napkins and a linen tablecloth. A small package thumped to the floor, but I didn't bother to examine it. I used the napkins to bind up Grandfather's jaw. I hesitated before moving him onto the tablecloth. Would he want to be buried in his nightshirt? A smile skirted across my face before I could stop it. I thought I heard him chuckle, but his body was as still as ever. He once told me that death is the eternal sleep. What could be more fitting than his nightshirt? Might be more comfortable than forcing him to wear tight clothing for eternity. He'd understand. I covered him with the tablecloth, but it sent an icy chill through me. I was supposed to cover his face. That's what people would expect. But I couldn't force myself to do it. He had such a kind face. I folded the tablecloth down below his chin. It looked like he was asleep. An owl hooted outside. I wondered where King George was, if he knew that Grandfather was gone. Maybe that's why King George had left us, to prepare a place for this old soldier. I sniffed and wiped a tear from my face. Silly to cry about a dead parrot, I told myself. The first tear gave way to another, and then another. I passed the night kneeling by the side of the finest man I had ever known, praying that the morning would not come.
Chapter 20, September 27th, 1793. Doctors raving and disputing. Death's pale army still recruiting. Philip Freneau, Pestilence, written during the prevalence of a yellow fever, 1793.
Bring out your dead!
What was that?
Bring out your dead!
The hoarse voice echoed off the cobblestones and brick houses. I opened the shutters a crack and peered out. A man dressed in rags pushed a large cart that already contained two corpses, a child and young woman, their skin tinted a pale yellow. The cart was not heavy, but the man walked slowly, as if he were pushing the weight of the world. My hands shook against the window frame. A cold wind from my nightmare blew through my mind. I had to remember something.
Bring out your dead!
Grandfather? I whirled. His body still lay on the floor. My stomach clenched. I ran outside and threw up what little was in my stomach on the side of the road. It wasn't a nightmare. It truly happened. All of it. The sour taste burned my mouth, and my hands would not stop shaking. There could be no running from this. Hiding from death was not like hiding from Mother when she wanted me to scrub kettles, or ignoring Silas when he begged for food. I was the only one left. I had to bury my grandfather. And soon.
Hot weather was most unkind to the dead. That was made painfully clear up at Bush Hill. I bit the inside of my cheek to stop the flow of tears. Crying wouldn't help anything. My duty was clear. I understood why the cart man walked so slowly. Death was a heavy companion. I wiped my mouth on the hem of my dress. The cart turned down 7th Street and headed south. I ran to catch up with it. A few minutes later, Grandfather's body was loaded into the death cart. When the man realized I would follow him to the park, he treated Grandfather's body with respect. He gave me time to dash upstairs and find Grandmother's portrait. Grandfather had looked upon her face every night before he fell asleep. I tucked it underneath his arm as he lay in the cart. It pained me that he could not be buried next to her in the churchyard. I hoped that taking her image to the grave with him would be a comfort. I nodded to the man. He struggled to push the cart. Grandfather's weight made it hard to manage. I tapped him on the shoulder. He looked me up and down once, then moved to the side. I grasped one of the cart handles with both hands. We both heaved, and the wheels rolled. Together, we pushed the cart to the burial ground. The funeral procession for Captain William Farnsworth Cook should have been loud and long, crowded with friends exchanging memories of the grand old man. But the streets were ghosted, colorless, and hushed. His casket should have been pulled by a fine white horse, not pushed by a girl and a stranger. I shifted my hands on the heavy handle. A sliver bit into my palm, and I couldn't stop the tears. He was truly gone. The burial square was quiet, yet busy with activity. 30, maybe 40 men were methodically digging the earth and laying the dead to rest. Two of them picked up Grandfather's body and laid it on a large canvas cloth that reminded me of a sail. They wrapped the cloth around him and quickly sewed the shroud shut with thick, curved needles. I stood behind them, silent and numb. They lifted Grandfather's shroud by the top and the bottom and prepared to fling it into the open grave. My voice erupted. Stop! All heads turned to look at me. I didn't realize what I had done at first. The men set the shroud on the ground. You can't just toss him in there like a sack of potatoes, I said. Where's the minister? You're not supposed to bury people without prayers. The men looked at each other. The one who stood at Grandfather's feet spoke softly.
The minister will come by later today and pray for all the dead, miss. There are so many people alive who need tending to. The dead have to wait their turn. I'm sure God will understand. Now please, miss, let us get on with this work.
He bent over to pick up the shroud.
Put him down, I said.
The men ignored me. A spiteful voice hissed in my head. Shut up, Maddie, the voice said.
You're a silly child. You have no business ordering these men around. Stop interfering and get out. This is no place for you. Get your sniveling self to the orphan house where they'll feed you and dry your tears.
My head throbbed to the rhythm of the shovels biting into the earth. My hands decided what to do without consulting the rest of my body. I shoved the man who spoke to me, shoved him so hard he nearly toppled into the grave. He scrambled to his feet, protesting. I ran up to him and clenched the front of his shirt in my blistered hands.
This was a great man, Captain William Farnsworth Cook of the Pennsylvanian 5th Regiment. He was my grandfather. You will not bury him without a prayer.
I spoke slowly, with iron force behind every word.
The lass is right,
said the man who pushed the cart. It was the first time he had spoken. He took a slim book from his pocket and offered it to me.
Can ye read?
I nodded and took the book from him. It was a copy of the Psalms,
the pages worn thin and dirty from frequent use. I stared at the gravediggers. They took off their caps and bowed their heads. Movement in the park stopped, as those watching laid down their shovels and bowed their heads. The book opened to the familiar words. I swallowed, cleared my throat, and began to read loudly so that all could hear.
The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want.
The men around me moved their lips and then gave voice. Our voices rose together as one, proclaiming faith, joining in grief. At the end of the reading, some crossed themselves, others wiped their eyes. I stood straight and tall.
Thank you.
I handed the book back and walked away. There was nothing more for me to do. My feet moved, taking me up one street and down the next. I didn't see another person for blocks, not even a gravedigger or a physician. The sound of my shoes tapping across the cobblestones echoed down the street like a latecomer sneaking into church. I walked past the homes of people acquainted with my family. They were all deserted. My shift darkened with sweat. Surely I wasn't the only person left in Philadelphia. My mind whirled. What to do? What to do? I should find a way to the Ludingtons. No, that would be impossible. I should go to the orphan house. They would take me in. The compass spun wildly. No, I could care for myself. I was not a child. Bush Hill. Mrs. Flagg would see that I was fed, and I could help care for the sick. But the memories of that place were filled with the sound of Grandfather's voice and the rumble of his laugh. Don't borrow trouble, that's what Eliza would say. Don't borrow trouble. I'd go to the market for some food. Then I'd hole up at home and wait for the frost. No one had a duty to me, and I had no claim on anyone else. But it mattered not. I would see my way through. My stomach took control. The first thing was to find a meal. I felt faint and queasy. I stood in the shade of a linden tree, then set out the short distance to the market. My steps slowed as I approached the market. No noise greeted me. I checked my bearings twice to make sure I had not taken a wrong turn. It was empty. A hot wind blew trash and dirt through the abandoned stalls. It looked like an enormous broom had swept away all the people. I thought of what Mrs. Bowles had said. Was the fever really keeping the farmers away? But how could city people eat if the market closed? Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a dark mass near an overturned basket. It could be potatoes or carrots. I picked up my skirts and hurried over to investigate. Rats. Shiny, slippery rats, fat and fast, poured in and out of the basket, twitching their noses and flicking their tails. I had never seen rats so far away from the river. Where were the dogs, the cats that kept them away? And what would I do now? How was I going to eat? A chest of gold wouldn't buy any food here today. A coughing fit overtook me, and I felt faint. I stumbled into Mrs. Epler's stall and sat in the stray white feathers that littered the ground. Now what? Take inventory. Check the pack and powder. I was alone. Grandfather was dead and Mother missing. I had survived the fever, but still felt weak. There was little food in the garden and no food to buy. Thieves and scoundrels prowled the streets. My pack was empty and my powder wet. I had no choice but to walk home, where I could at least lock the doors. When I came upon the open windows of the Federal Gazette office, It was a shock. A horse was tethered by the door. I stumbled through the door, eager for a friendly face.
Can I help you?
It's me, Mr. Brown, William Cook's granddaughter. The printer looked up from his